Morning, everybody. Jeff Chancellor is my name, one of the, described by Michael as senior personal injury lawyers on the Greens list. I've been promoted to the role of chairman. I've given papers in the past. I was probably a bit slow in preparing them, so it was a good idea because maybe this is slightly easier than actually preparing the papers. Welcome. Congratulations on most of you getting here so early. I think there are a few more to come. This is, I think, the 13th breakfast briefing that Greens List has provided since the start of the CPD year, and no doubt there are many more to come. It's obviously a good way to pick up your CPD points, intermingle the two parts of the profession. And this morning's topics are slip and trip claims. And I think once you've had the slip and trip, you may have a level of disability which entitles you to some sort of superannuation or insurance claim for disability insurance. We've got two presenters this morning. First in line is Fiona Ryan, who looks to be very well prepared with the slip and trip there. Fiona is a former Holding Redlich solicitor who came to the bar about 6 years ago, and is a general personal injury lawyer. She also dabbles in administrative law, has done some migration cases, and I'll dob her in for this one. She also does some Veterans Affairs cases, because there's not many of us who do those. And if you think the Accident Compensation Act is difficult to get through, have a look at the Veterans Entitlements Act. And Fiona's done very well to prepare this at short notice, because she's got a nine-month-old baby, and she's actually flying out to New York tomorrow. So her paper isn't in the documents, but it will be emailed from New York. And our other speaker is Chris Hansen, who's, I'll call him a dual MBA. He's a Master of Business Administration and also a motorbike aeronautist, a very keen cyclist. He's got a lot of commercial experience. He worked at what was once called National Mutual, is now, or was AXA, and maybe now AMP, but whatever. So he's familiar with the insurance superannuation side of things. He's been at the bar for about 12 years, dealing in mainly commercial areas. Just thinking with the slips and trips, there were major changes to public liability laws, I think about 2002, 2003, throughout Australia, because unfortunately companies like AXA and National Mutual were going broke and they were paying out far too much money. But that's meant there's been quite a lot of litigation, particularly in New South Wales. I don't know whether they slip more or whether they litigate more. But if you get the Barnett Jade cases, which I assume most of you do, you'll see that the New South Wales Supreme Court is quite frequently dealing with the slip and trip cases. While I'm talking about useful websites, the other one is the Lawyer's Toolkit / Full Kit, which is also pretty useful in terms of providing a range of information. So sit back and enjoy, and I'll pass over to Fiona.
Thanks, Jeff. You will be getting a copy of the slides emailed to you, and they're quite detailed, so please don't feel like you have to write anything down. I should say, there are many slides, and the reason why that's the case is because this is a quite wide and detailed topic, which I realised in the midst of preparing it. So I've covered quite a lot of material that I won't be able to get through in the short time we have this morning, which is why the slides are more detailed than they would otherwise be. In terms of slip and trip claims, as we say, we're dealing with common law negligence as well as the Victorian Wrongs Act, which covers occupier's liability or the statutory duty, and there is some codification of negligence, and the Road Management Act. And that provides protection for a road authority, and that comes up in terms of the footpath cases. So if you're going to sue a council for a slip and trip, you've got to first go to the Road Management Act, because there are wide-ranging protections there that are afforded to a road authority. As I said, the The Wrongs Act and Part 10 of the Wrongs Act does codify to some extent the common law, although it does not purport to replace it. As Jeff said, there were changes to the law in about 2002, 2003. So as most of you will know, slip and trip claims are subject to significant injury provisions. So the plaintiff, of course, must have a significant injury, either psychiatric injury or physical injury, if he or she wishes to pursue damages for pain and suffering. And as all the plaintiff solicitors out there know, it's important to satisfy the various provisions of the Wrongs Act dealing with certificates of assessment and referral to medical panels and so forth. In terms of slip and trip claims, just from a starting point, it's important to consider Part 10 of the Wrongs Act. And the first step, that is indeed the first step, and that's what the High Court pointed out in Adeel's Palace. In practice in Victoria, and I've had a look at a couple of county court judgments dealing with these matters, judges have tended to treat the provisions of the Wrongs Act as more or less the same as the common law. But it's still important to go through the provisions of the Wrongs Act because there are differences, particularly in the provisions relating to causation. The Wrongs Act provides a statutory duty for occupiers' liability. I've just set out the sections there. It's not controversial and reflects the common law. The duty owed is a duty to take such care as was reasonable in all the circumstances. So again, this is basic stuff and I'm sure is familiar to a lot of you, but I think it's useful if we think about how a case is framed, because often in practice we get clients in for either drawing a statement of claim or defence, and we're so used to dealing with the day-to-day ins and outs of practice that we don't often sit down and think about actually how is a claim or a defence framed. Now, Part 10 of the Wrongs Act deals with negligence, and Sections 48, 49 and 50 talk about breach of duty. They're actually entitled duty of care, but they really go to breach of duty. They're taken from the principles enunciated by Justice Mason in Wyong Shire. And I just noted there that considerations of breach of duty, that is whether the respondent has, or the defendant, I should say, has acted reasonably in response to the risk, must be undertaken prospectively and not in hindsight. I've just set out the sections there. I won't go through them, but the plaintiff will have to satisfy all three elements set out there in relation to breach of duty. That is, the risk was foreseeable, not insignificant, and in the circumstances, a reasonable person, being the defendant, would have taken those precautions, whatever precautions the plaintiff said the defendant should have taken. The Act also sets out the considerations, amongst others, in determining whether a reasonable person would have taken precautions against a risk of harm. And some of them have set out there. As you'll see, they're the same as the common law. One of the most important things in terms of framing a claim is to identify the risk of harm that the defendant was obliged to have taken precautions against. And the High Court's pointed out that it is only through the correct identification of the risk of harm that the court, that should be, can assess what a reasonable response to that risk would be. And so there have been a lot of cases, I've just noticed in reading, where the trial judge has misconstrued the risk of harm and therefore his or her assessment of whether or not the defendant has breached the duty has therefore been incorrect as well. So it's important from both the plaintiff and defendant's perspective that the risk of harm is clearly identified. The plaintiff must, of course, establish the risk was foreseeable. And that's whether a person in the defendant's position would have foreseen that its conduct involved a risk of injury to the plaintiff or a class of persons, including the plaintiff. And considerations to that question include common knowledge and experience of others in the similar position of the defendant, public notoriety of a particular risk of harm, obviousness or likelihood of the event occurring when using common sense. The risk must not be insignificant, and there's a definition in the Act. Again, it's no different from the common law, and it is still, of course, the case that it is enough that the kind or type of injury was foreseeable. You don't have to pinpoint the exact injury suffered. I've just set out that the final consideration is section 48.1 there. And once the first two elements have established, the court will then turn to the question of breach, and that's in most cases the most significant question. And I want to talk about obvious risk because in talking to some solicitors, that's a question that a lot of them raise in terms of these kind of cases. And that is no doubt because of the High Court's decision in Gantus in 2001, where you'll recall Justice Callinan made the comment, the world is not a level playing field. And the court, what the court was really saying is that people, pedestrians, will ordinarily be, will be expected to exercise sufficient care by looking where they are going and avoiding obvious hazards. So what that really means is a defendant or an occupier or a council will not be in breach of its duty when a risk is so obvious that no action need be taken in response of that risk. When looking at the High Court's language in Gantus, I think it's important, and I haven't set it out, but much of it is talking about pedestrian taking care to observe in broad daylight and terms like that. And where plaintiffs have succeeded in these cases is where there may indeed be an obvious risk, say in a footpath, but at the time the plaintiff had the fall, the risk was not obvious by, for example, a shadow that was cast by reason of a tree at a certain time of the day when the plaintiff fell. So although the risk in broad daylight may have been obvious, at the time when the plaintiff fell, it was not obvious. So obvious risk is not the end of these kind of cases. And, of course, every case must be looked at on its facts. Now, obvious risk, there are two times this comes up. It's defined in the Wrongs Act as applicable to a defence of voluntary assumption of risk. And it's also a factor to be taken into account, as in Gantus, in determining the reasonable response of a defendant to a foreseeable risk of harm, that is, whether the defendant breaches duty. In the Wrongs Act, obvious risk is contained in sections 53 and 54, and it's applicable to the common law defence of voluntary assumption of risk. The question is whether the risk was obvious to the plaintiff or a reasonable person in the plaintiff's position, and there's definitions of obvious risk there. And if the defence of voluntary assumption of risk is raised and the risk of harm is obvious, the plaintiff is presumed to have been aware of the risk unless, and the onus is on the plaintiff here, he or she proves on the balance of probabilities that he or she was not aware of the risk. So that's where obvious risk fits in with the Wrongs Act, when a defendant has pleaded voluntary assumption of risk, and then you look at the definitions of obvious risk in terms of how it relates to that defence. At the common law, it's only one of the considerations to be taken into account in determining whether a defendant has breached its duty, and it is not necessarily determinative. And this is important, and the High Court's observed in Thompson, if an expectation that other people will take care for their own safety were conclusive against liability in every case, there would be little room for a doctrine of contributory negligence. So, I mean, it's really a matter of looking at the case that's presented to you, and it may be that the risk is so obvious as to mean that a defendant did not have to respond to it. But in many cases, it will only be but one factor, and it won't be the end of the case for the plaintiff. This is a case of a couple of years ago of the Victorian Supreme Court, and I've just included this because the trial judge did make findings about obvious risk. The family of a deceased sued. The deceased attempted to slide down an embankment in Lawn, I believe in order to get to the beach, and ended up rolling down the embankment, striking her head on the concrete drain cover at the foot of the embankment, and she died. The last part of the embankment was very steep, and as I said, there was a concrete drain cover at the bottom. The trial judge held that it was reasonable for the committee, in that case the defendant, to have taken no steps in response to the foreseeable risk, largely because it was sufficiently obvious. And in that case, the plaintiff was alleging, among other things, that the defendant should have erected a fence, and that in fact the defendant did, after the accident, erect the fence, and that the defendant should have erected a warning sign. The Court of Appeal overturned the judgment and found for the plaintiff, held that the relevant risk was the risk of injury or death caused by losing control whilst ascending the steep embankment. The Court of Appeal in this case found that the trial judge had incorrectly framed the risk of harm as well. The defendants knew the embankment was frequently used in this manner. Lighting at night was poor. There was a foreseeable risk of injury, and the installation of a fence, which was in fact constructed shortly afterwards, was a cheap way of preventing access to the embankment, and that the failure of the defendant to take these or any other steps, being erecting warning signs and so forth, was in fact unreasonable. So that's a case where obvious risk was of course raised. The trial judge relied heavily on it in relation to finding no breach, and the Court of Appeal has overturned that decision. The Court of Appeal focused on the fact that the fact that the bottom of the embankment was suddenly quite steep, which was in fact hidden from the plaintiff, would have been hidden from the plaintiff or other people in the plaintiff's position, and that there was a concrete drain there, which was also hidden, went to had to be considered in taking account what was the risk of harm and whether that risk was in fact obvious. Section 51 of the Wrongs Act has reintroduced the but-for test. You should look at the High Court case of Adil's Palace. I've set out the citation earlier in the slides. The plaintiff now has to establish it was more probable than not that if the defendant had responded reasonably, the injury would not have occurred. This is in contrast to the common law test previous or set out in March and Stramere, that of material contribution. The but-for test is somewhat limiting when there are two or more causative events or when a defendant asserts a supervening cause. In practice in Victoria, although judges have certainly accepted that is now the test, it hasn't made an enormous amount of difference yet in terms of how cases are run or indeed how they're concluded. But it is important to remember the test is now different. Someone could probably do a whole talk about causation. I won't today, but just it is important to be aware of that. Contributory negligence is not to be forgotten, because contributory negligence is often raised in these cases and is often found against the plaintiff to at least some extent. It reflects the common law and the Act. I've just included a New South Wales Court of Appeal case there, which is just of some interest. The plaintiff exited out of a car park via some stairs. She misjudged where the landing was. It was quite dark at the time, and she fell down the stairs and suffered injury. She sued the occupier of the car park as well as the council as the road authority. They were found liable, but she was held guilty of contributory negligence to the order of 50% because she let go of the handrail and she moved quickly while ascending the stairs and while there was inadequate lighting, and the court found that was contributory negligence in the order of 50%. So contributory negligence is commonly raised in these sort of cases, and it's common that a court will find against a plaintiff to some extent, particularly when the plaintiff is in that circumstance, moving around in the dark. She knew it was dark. She let go of the handrail when she shouldn't have. She should have taken more reasonable care. And I've just included this case, which is another New South Wales case. As Jeff said, I don't know if they get injured more or sue more, but just to put in context how all these principles work, this was a case where a plaintiff was injured at a gym. She was walking down a set of stairs. There was no handrail. On her right, there was a stub wall, which is apparently a short wall. She put her hand on that to steady herself, lost her footing and fell and suffered injury. The defendant, well, the managing director of the defendant, gave evidence that he did not consider there was a requirement for a handrail and that he had in fact been able to steady himself when going down the stairs by grabbing the top of the stub wall. Now, in this case, the plaintiff was 4'10". The court found the defendant did owe her a duty to exercise reasonable care, and that a reasonable person in the position of the defendant would have concluded a foreseeable risk to females of short stature, that's the court's wording, not mine, particularly if that person had small hands. Now, what all that means is she was unable to properly grab the wall, I think because of her height and the fact that she had small hands, when descending the flight of stairs. And the court found that persons of small stature would not be able to grip the top of that wall as a means of support. So the risk was not insignificant. The defendant breached its duty by failing to install a handrail, and the burden of installing a handrail was small, both by way of expense and inconvenience. And the defendant in this case said, well, we've had this gym open for X amount of time and no one's ever fallen down the stairs before. And the court said, no, bad luck. Absence of previous falls is not decisive, and it's only one factor to be taken into account when determining foreseeability and breach of duty, a reasonable response. And this is another New South Wales case where the plaintiff was unsuccessful. This is a Supreme Court case. The plaintiff attended a concert at a primary school. Her 5-year-old daughter was performing. She crossed a road on school premises at a pedestrian crossing. She slipped and fell and sustained serious injuries to her face and elbow. She sued the proprietor of the school and the maintenance contractor in negligence. She slipped on a school crossing and was alleging that the defendant should have painted the crossing with non-slip paint and so forth, both the defendants, I should say. It had been drizzling rain before the accident, so the court found that it was damp, but it wasn't in fact raining when she fell. The court enunciated the risk of harm, you'll see there, the risk of a person such as the plaintiff when using the particular pedestrian crossing by walking normally in its then condition, slipping on the painted surface and suffering personal injury. The court found against the plaintiff at the stage of foreseeability and determined there was nothing about the crossing that would have alerted either defendant to the existence of a potential hazard. There were no previous reported accidents, no unusual features, nothing visible on the pedestrian crossing that suggested it may have been particularly slippery. Now, I should say the judge also went through the other steps and found against the plaintiff on causation as well, and the plaintiff did not prove that there was anything about the pedestrian crossing that caused the fall. The Road Management Act 2004 is essential when a plaintiff wishes to sue a road authority, being a council, for example, in a footpath case. The duty owed is to all users of the road or footpath, but the level of that duty is directed at persons taking reasonable care for their own safety. The liability of road authorities, is governed by Part 6 of the Road Management Act. And it was enacted in response to the High Court's removal of the common law doctrine of nonfeasance. And basically, the Act confers a nonfeasance protection, but it is not absolute. I should say, for the purposes of the Road Management Act, a road authority is not an occupier. They do have a duty to inspect, maintain, and repair public roads, and a public road includes a footpath. So Section 102 confers nonfeasance protection, and what that means is that the council cannot be liable for a failure to remove a hazard, repair a defect, or give a warning of a hazard, defect, or deterioration in a road unless there is actual knowledge of a risk. We'll come to what actual knowledge is, but I've just pointed out there that Section 102, that protection does not include a protection for failure to inspect a public road. It is arguable that if the road authority had inspected the footpath, for example, it would have had actual knowledge, so therefore is not entitled to the protection for failing to repair the defect. Now, there is no Victorian case law I can find on the Road Management Act. It just hasn't been dealt with yet. I don't know if people aren't running these cases or they're all settling, but there is New South Wales law of equivalent provisions in the Civil Liability Act. And they have interpreted the meaning of actual knowledge. It was interpreted in a case of North Sydney Council and Roman of the Court of Appeal of New South Wales. An actual knowledge must be found in the mind of an officer within the council who had authority to carry out the necessary repairs. And in that case, no officer at a decision-making level had actual knowledge. So really what the section's saying is it's not just good enough that they had constructive knowledge and that they ought to have known. It's an evidentiary point. You've got to prove that they had actual knowledge. And this will be, sometimes it will be easier than others. For example, in a case where someone trips outside their, or in a neighbourhood, it may be that neighbours have in fact complained to the council, and that's perhaps more likely than, say, if someone falls on a busy road. So it's really a question of looking at if there have been any complaints. Often complaints, you will find complaints if you do an FOI request. There's another policy defence. There's a policy defence in Section 103 of the Act. If the road authority's act or omission is in accordance with a policy, and usually that will be their road management plan, will not be wrongful unless the policy is so unreasonable that no minister acting reasonably would have made the decision. The question there, of course, is whether the policy was in fact adhered to and whether the relevant part of the policy was reasonable. I'm aware of the time, so I won't spend too long on this, but there's a defence of reasonable care in Section 105, and that again addresses a policy. In the footpath cases, it'll be the council's road management plan. There's a defence if the defendant had a policy which addressed the matter, which was a cause of the defect, and it complied with the relevant part of the policy. It'll have to be determined as to whether that plan did in fact address the matter, and a court will have to be satisfied that the policy did in fact address the cause of the defect adequately, arguably. So to conclude, A plaintiff must clearly identify the risk of harm. If the risk is obvious, it is not necessarily fatal to a claim in negligence. And while the protection afforded to a road authority appears ironclad, this may not, in fact, prove to be the case. Thank you.